This is the DRF Players Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the May 17th version of the DRF Players Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornatel, back with you alongside the usual crew, sitting in the other corner of the DRF offices in the shadow of the Chrysler Building. We have at DRF Formulator himself, Mike Hogan. And from some random hotel lobby in a state that I'm not even aware of which one it is, we have at UT Big Hair, Jonathan Kitchen. What's going on, gentlemen?
So I hear you're in the building, but I have not seen you yet, Pete. So maybe after this we can shake hands and say hi. But I'm doing good. Only a few more days until Preakness, and getting excited.
Hotel lobby of the great in the great state of Texas in Austin, so it's not too crazy. I'm just I was out and about. I didn't get to get back to the office in time, so I just did a little makeshift office here in the W Hotel lobby, which is a pretty nice one here in Austin, Texas.
You actually sound clearer and better than usual, Jonathan, for whatever it's worth. I don't know, but you sound closer than Mike sounds, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, I came in the city today. I had an opportunity to have lunch with Roxy Roxborough, who's in town, and also with our mutual friend Mandy Minger, who's one of the main reasons I work here at DRF. But, gentlemen, it's sort of a calm before the storm type of show. We've got a lot of action coming up this weekend. We're going to talk maybe a little bit about some of that fun stuff happening Friday and Saturday during the show. But we'll be back to have a whole separate conversation later in the week. So I say what we do today is we take a look back at the public handicapper races from last weekend, and we're going to bring in a special guest, a guest who just qualified on drfqualify.com for this weekend's Santa Anita Preakness Challenge contest that I will be attending in person. And I believe Mr. Kinchin may be attending in person himself. And the fellow who won in last weekend, Duke Matisse, one of the most accomplished tournament players there is, and we'll bring him in for a little roundtable discussion about his life and times later in the show. But before we get to that, I think we should talk about these races from the weekend. Mike, I'll start with you. Was there a particular performance that stood out to you this past Saturday and Sunday?
Well, I think we were all wrong about cavorting. and I think that even though it wasn't one of the public handicapper races, one of the races, probably the standout one and the one worth most discussion, I think, was one we covered a little bit on last week's podcast, which was Unified in the Peter Pan. But as far as the other races go, nothing really jumped out too much. I think Unified was probably the most interesting one going forward, though.
Jonathan, how about you? A particular performance that impressed you over the weekend, be it in one of the public handicapper races or just out there in the world in general?
Yeah, no, I was plugged into the Man of War. I thought that was a pretty exciting race, and Wake Forest kind of made me feel better about the money that I lost on him when he was down in South Florida. And then a good handicapping point, and I tweeted about this too, is a horse that was not on my radar until I saw the DRF Clocker report and noticed that Money Multiplier had been working with arguably the best turf horse on American soil in Flintshire. And that was a big awakening for me that Chad Brown and his barn felt really good about Money Multiplier and the horse that he's become. I think he's a 4-year-old, and so and he ran like it too. He ran really well, and was 17-1, and it took just Chad's other good horse to run him down.
I think Norm Cassie might have crossed you off his Christmas card list based on that statement, but I do agree Flincher's form extremely impressive and certainly did provide some clues to Money Multiplier. I happened to hear Chad Brown earlier this week on the Steve Bick show making a few comparisons, some superficial, some deep, between Money Multiplier and Big Blue Kitten. Both are Ridgelings, both sort of coming along a little bit later in their career, had some success at 3, but looking to a brighter future at 4 and beyond. And he just made the point that he thinks that distance is going to be this horse's friend. I thought the horse ran his eyeballs out in the race, almost ridden effectively as a rabbit. but boy, a rabbit who could still finish a little bit. I wanted to talk to you guys about Wake Forest, who I obviously like. We talked about a lot on the show. I thought it was very interesting. It points out why trip handicapping is one of the most interesting aspects of thoroughbred handicapping in general, and that's because what trip handicapping is each individual's subjective view of a race. And sometimes people whose opinions you respect and often will have a completely different thought on a trip. That happened to me on Saturday watching the NYRA pregame show and hearing David and Andy, both of whom have opinions I respect, talk about how they thought Wake Forest had had a perfect trip in the previous race. I had said on the show and continue to believe that he had sort of a tough go of it in that previous race simply because he was produced so late on. We didn't really talk about this that much in depth before the race, so I'll ask you guys after. Do you think there's something to my view of Wake Forest's trip in the previous race, or do you think those guys have it right and I just have it wrong?
Well, I think, you know, to kind of more to your point rather than to answer your question, because I'm not really 100% sure. I mean, obviously his performance moving out of that race shows that he probably was negatively affected from the trip down in South Florida. But I think the biggest thing is that each evaluation of a trip, whether it's the horse lost ground or the horse saved ground, those things can both be negative depending on the type of horse and the way the race was run. You know, if it's a collapse and the horse loses ground six wide, that could be actually an advantage. It depends on how the horse is. The same thing with an inside trip, you know. If the horse doesn't really quicken and has one long run, then an inside trip could be bad. If it's a horse that's saving ground and maybe is a little bit distance limited and can quicken at that point when they actually get free, that's why I think it's subjective, it's so tricky and people can have so many different opinions, is because, you know, a wide trip can be good and it can be bad. So now it's the subjectivity comes in where you're trying to decide how it affected that horse that day.
And I can't say that I'm going to crow and say, oh, the result of the race proved I was right about Wake Forest. I'm sure someone could argue that he simply came on for having the run. I just thought it was an interesting example. And, boy, there was a moment there where it looked like Wake Forest might get stymied in the stretch, but found room at the right time and got to the wire and got it done for his backers. Mike mentioned cavorting as one of the performances of the weekend that we at least in terms of the show, had kind of slept on. I'll be the first to admit I did not see that one coming. Mike, what do you think was going on there that we needed to pay attention to that we missed?
I don't know. I mean, I guess if you forgive a few of those efforts, and maybe look to, you know, this is still a somewhat young, now 4-year-old filly. Fillies can sometimes be a little temperamental. Had shown some brilliance in the past, and for whatever reason, just put it all together on Saturday. I guess that's the case for her. We all kind of doubted whether or not she wanted to go that far. We doubted whether the best races were behind her, but boy, from that performance, she showed she, at least in one-turn races at Belmont, she can be a major force.
Now, in the Bogey, the race that gave the public handicapper recap of the email of the weekend its title, Strike Charmer got the job done. I know this is one, Jonathan, that you had warmed to. I'm going to go ahead and say I was awfully unlucky. I bet Recepta in the race. I had, before doing the 100% job on my handicapping on Friday's show, talked about giving Recepta a pass for the previous race simply based on being quote-unquote horrified by Teppan. And while I do think that's true to some degree, what I realized when I watched the tape was she might well have run in the money in that race had she not been sawed off early. However, no better luck this time for Recepta, sawed off once again in that stage of the race where the turf courts meets the rail, and I thought ran incredibly well to do any running after that. What were your thoughts in general on the Bogey, Jonathan?
Yeah, no, my Miss Sophia didn't do herself any favors. She was pretty aggressive in that race. I thought that that Strike Trauma got an unbelievable ride by a rat. I text our buddy Nick Tamaro right after, like, I was, like, cursing at him, like, what are you doing? Come on, what are you doing? And he kept waiting and waiting and waiting, and then he just exploded by. You know, I think that was just a brilliant ride, and when you need a patient ride like that, I don't know if there's anyone else you want on your horse other than Irad.
He sometimes does give these rides that are, like, as if he studies tape of Ramon Dominguez rides, and I think that was one of them, just having this incredible, almost icy patience and knowing just when to push the button there. Mike, did you have any thoughts on the Bogey?
No, I think I had a Tapestry Recepta Exactabox, so I got a little doubly unlucky, and I also liked it. You know, I mentioned on the show I liked Tapestry to win the race. And she ran well, but boy, Strike Charmer put it all together. Now 6-year-old mare, if that's one she can move forward on, she's a player in the older filly and mare turf division, as long as it doesn't involve Teppan.
You guys have both given out the winner of the Las Barrera, as I recall, and a halfway decent price with I Will Score paying $880. I'll be honest, I still haven't even watched the tape of the race. So what did I miss, Jonathan?
I'm trying to remember. I think he broke well and went on with it. The horse that I was kind of deciding, I was kind of flip-flopping back and forth on.
Smoky Image.
When mm-hmm. I finally got my hands on the workout report, it wasn't glowing. And that's when I kind of said that, you know, like I mentioned on the show, I was going to go in the direction that the workout report kind of pushed me in, and it pushed me towards I Will Score, and he ran really well. I was impressed. You know, it reminded me of the race that kind of caught my attention earlier in the winter out at Santa Anita.
Right, definitely a nice reward for the backers. Not the only horse that folks had talked about on the podcast that delivered a result for a podcast listener over the weekend. What was that story about the trip horse you mentioned a few weeks ago, Jonathan? And somebody on Twitter hit the pick four, keying the horse. And if you can give the guy props and remember his name, all the more credit. I can't, but I
don't remember his name, but it was the player we were talking about Derby Day, and how I was so excited for this horse, the player that had a weird trip at Keeneland. And our buddy John Nichols had raved about the horse's workouts leading up to Derby Week. He was entered on the AE list on Derby Day. Actually, it was an MTO on the turf. I don't know what they were doing there. Then they finally ran him on Saturday, and he won for absolute fun. He was 1-2, but it's the type of horse, if you can single in a pick four, pick five, and make some money on it, then it's always a good thing. So he sent a tweet out saying that he's glad he listened, because he singled the horse as well.
You know what
I believe
always
his name
say.
Is Nick.
Nick, there you go.
N. Rogers.
And you know, that lesson that I always like to repeat, better a short price than a long face, at least when it comes to your multi-race exotic sequences. Let's talk about the Peter Pan for a minute. I thought it was an interesting race. I had, talk about short prices, I had tied up Unified in several things. The top of the lane, I think, oh my goodness, this horse is going to win by 10. I'm in great, great shape. About the 16th pole, I wasn't so sure. The thing I'll say, though, I did feel encouraged by the fact that he rebroke on the gallop out and actually galloped out pretty well. I think this is a horse with, undeniable talent at this point. If he were yours, Jonathan, what do you think you'd be looking to do next with Unified?
Oh, I'd run him in the Met Mile. I mean, what's the point of jacking with what's going in the right direction? You know, the Belmont's the type of race I feel like will break a horse if the horse isn't ready for that situation. And the amount of pace that horse showed and his starts already, it feels like he's going to want to be forwardly placed. And it just feels like the Belmont could be the type of situation that can gut him. A Met Mile win or a Met Mile placing and keeping the horse around for the rest of the summer, I think does just as much for his resume as winning the Belmont.
Well, I would argue in terms of the breeding industry, we know the Met Mile is a stallion-making race. You can argue the Belmont, maybe not so much in the last couple of results, but sort of more historically looking at the last 10 or 15 years, it's almost an anti-stallion race, at least in some people's views. So that plan certainly makes a ton of sense for a lot of reasons. I haven't really read too much about what the plans are for Unified, what options they're weighing. Mike, can you give us any kind of update about what the plans are for Unified?
Yeah, right after the race, Dave Grenning said that trainer Jimmy Jurkins was, you know, obviously pleased with the performance, wanted to keep him at two turns, but thought that, wanted to try him at two turns, but thought that the mile and a half of the Belmont in, what, the fourth career start may be a little much, too much too soon. Was kind of on the fence and kind of reading between the lines, it sounded like if on Saturday Nyquist or somebody wins convincingly and goes on to the Belmont, most likely we wouldn't see Unified there. He mentioned the Pegasus at Monmouth as a possibility, which may be a stepping stone for the Haskell. So I'm guessing they're going to at least try a few stakes at two turns and then see what they've got.
Go ahead.
Sorry, who are we scared of if you have Unified in the Met Mile? I mean, I'm about to like start Googling. I can't even think of who's going to run in there that's like a problem.
Is there any talk of that? Is there any talk of did you hear anybody mention anything about him in the Met Mile? Because, like Jonathan, that's kind of where my head went.
Yeah, you know, I think probably it more has to do with keeping him against three-year-olds than keeping him at a mile. But I don't know. I hadn't seen any talk about that mile. I guess that would make sense if they wanted to keep him at a one-turn race at Belmont, but I don't know if, you know, Jurkins is kind of notoriously conservative, I guess, and probably just doesn't want to try him against older horses at this point in his career.
Well, we'll have to see how that all shakes out. He's certainly one of the sharper guys around, Jimmy Jurkins, and he's not going to let a really good opportunity go by without having a very good reason to do so. So we'll keep tabs on that story and see what happens. I mean, he must have a plan A and a plan. Imagine you have a horse like that. You have a plan A, B, all the way down to E or F. So we'll have to see what happens. It is one of the stories we'll be following here over the next few weeks and months on the DRF Players Podcast. All right, folks, for the second half of the show, we're going to bring in our very special guest. He's one of the most accomplished players in handicapping contest history, as far as I'm concerned. He's also a professional player and one of the just generally sharper guys around. He is Duke Matisse. Duke, how are you doing today?
Hey, what's going on, Pete?
It's all great to have you on the show. Thank you so much for making the voyage along with us. We've had your brother on, but we haven't had you on before, so this is long overdue. How are you doing today? Everything good out there? Are you in California?
Yeah, California's a little overcast today, but it's still better than being anywhere else, I think.
And you know what you speak, because you've lived in the Northeast, you've lived out in Vegas, but for you, California remains number one with a bullet?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I can't. I don't think I'll ever leave here. Ever since I moved west to Vegas and then finally got to California, I've been here for, you know, about 14 years now. I don't see myself going back east except to visit Saratoga in the summertime.
How much time do you typically spend back home, quote unquote, for the meet?
This year, I'm planning on spending the most time that I have in the last 10 or 15 years. I'm planning on going for about 3.5 weeks through the tournament at Saratoga.
Oh, fantastic!
From the beginning of the meet till through the tournament. Yeah.
So now I've witnessed and I talked to your brother about this. I've witnessed the sort of Matisse family reunions that seem to take place at those picnic tables out by the Big Red Spring at Saratoga. But one thing I haven't gotten that clear of a window is what it was like for you guys growing up. Is that something that you've been doing since way back? And just generally speaking, what was it like growing up Matisse?
Believe it or not, growing up Matisse involved a lot of bowling. So it didn't involve a lot of horse racing at first. All I did was pretty much bowl every day of my life. And Jonathan's seen me bowl a few times, so he can attest to that.
Is he any good, JK?
He's phenomenal. He can like go between legs. He can go around. He's unbelievable. Unbelievable. We actually did a game where there was two of us versus him, and it was close. We actually pulled it off, but it was close.
Yeah, but my horse racing life was going to Saratoga and the Massachusetts Fair Circuit. My dad loved the Massachusetts Fair Circuit, and so we used to go there in the summertime and go to Saratoga almost every weekend and spend a lot of time in the infield when I was a kid. They used to have the infield open back in the 70s and 80s, so I spent a lot of time in the infield at Saratoga, and my brother Paul was always big into, you know, timing races and reading the form, and I wasn't at first, and he kind of showed me the way a little bit when I was younger, and obviously my dad read the form, and just spent a lot of time at the racetrack. Actually, the most time I probably spent at Saratoga was picking up tickets. I used to be one of those stupers. I used to go around Saratoga at about 8 years old and pick up tickets, and I tell you what, I made a few dollars doing that.
Yes, back in the day before ADWs and wagering cards, especially a meet like Saratoga, I imagine there was a dollar or two left on the floor there, left on the apron. And for folks listening saying, apron, Saratoga infield, yes, Duke and I are just about the same age, and we are old. But so you talk about your brother getting into the sort of studious side of handicapping. When you started taking it seriously, was it sort of on his coattails and a little bit the coattails of your dad, or did you get into it independent of those guys?
No, I kind of just followed. I really was going to be a professional bowler, and I decided that at some point there wasn't enough money in it. And when I went to college with my brother Paul, he was a senior at Buffalo State, and I was a freshman. And we used to go to Fort Erie Racetrack, skip class and go to Fort Erie most of the days, and go there at night. And at Greenwood was running back then, and Greenwood was like a bull ring track. I think it was 5 furlong track, and the inside post was dynamite at Greenwood. And we basically got through. Got our spending money in college by going to betting Greenwood at night, you know, going across the border from Buffalo to Canada. And, I just learned, I watched a lot of races as a kid, and I think that's what most people probably don't have the experience of. I've probably seen more races in my life than probably anyone. I mean, really, because I watch replays and I watched, you know, all these minor league tracks when I was a kid and learned from the bottom up, and I think that helped me a lot, because I would take the form and I'd say, why did that horse win? Why did this horse win? Why did that horse run second? You know, and I would look at it after the fact, and I think just from trial and error and learning and watching a lot of races and Paul doing speed figures helped, because I learned that too. I learned how fast horses could be and designing races in my head and all that stuff. I think just added up and went from there.
Is it correct to say that your brother is more on the figure side of the equation and you're more of the trips and biases part of the pie?
Yeah, exactly. He does. He actually does all the speed figures. I only help him out when he feels like the other day, I think he put a tweet out saying he'd rather take a physics class than do the speed figures at Belmont this week. So he said they were that hard. So he calls me in those cases when he thinks they're that hard to do, and I help him. But I don't really know the background of the charts and all that, you know, what goes into, you know, and the run-ups, all the run-ups at all these tracks. I don't know a lot of that stuff that he knows. So eventually he's going to have to teach me that too, because somebody else has got to know how to do it. You know, you can't just have one person, you know, not here. So I got to learn how to do that. But I'm more into the trip bias, you know, replays, and Jonathan, I think, is a little bit into that too.
Yeah, it's nice to be able to have all those different clubs in your bag as a handicapper. I feel like in the old days when you went around the track, even among smart players, you'd hear people say, I'm a speed guy, I'm a pace guy, I'm a trips guy. And I think these days, with as hard as the game has gotten, you kind of have to be all those guys if you're going to survive in such a competitive environment. Duke, would you agree with that, that the game has gotten tougher over the last several years?
Oh, for sure. For sure. When I moved to Vegas in 96, 97, I thought it was easy. It seemed like it was easy. It just seemed like, you know, if the horse, you know, went, got the lead and you know, and the track was playing, you know, inside Spina, it just seemed like the game was easier. And now, I think with all the medications and all the different styles of trading, these guys, like, they don't run the horses as much. So I think the jockeys are a lot weaker in this day and age. I think that is something that people don't talk about a lot. But I think back in the 90s, that you had fantastic jockeys. I mean, they didn't make as many mistakes as these guys make. And I think it's a lot of factors. I think there weren't as much, you know, sharp guys, you know, there weren't any computer bettors back then. There weren't as many speed figures out there. There was only sheets and buyers, you know.
Yeah, we talked to Paul about that idea that you have, that so much of the smart money in the market now is being generated by these computer programs, the types of which, you know, used to only be seen in markets on Wall Street, and now you've got that same type of computing power in the parimutuel pools, and you're knocking heads with it. Do you have any specific strategies, or, I mean, and you'd have to be willing to generous and willing to share it, even if you did, and I wouldn't blame you if you didn't want to, but do you have any specific ways of plotting different types of bets to specifically either target or at least work around all that smart money that's being generated by the computer models?
I think those guys are really good when I say the race seems, you know, chalky, or when the race seems not, when it's going to run normal. But when you can come up with something out of the ordinary, like maybe a horse that's never been on the turf, and, you know, his first time on the turf, and he's got some breeding on, you know, breeding on both sides, that kind of thing. I think they miss that stuff. Or a horse that was really against the bias last time, I think that's another thing that those guys aren't that great at. But I think what they are really good at is narrowing the race down to the contenders and then just, you know, basically trying to break even. They're just taking money out of the pool. They're taking money away from guys like me and Jonathan and you. And I can't blame them either. You know, that they've designed their program to do what it does, and they make money doing it. But I don't really call what they do handicapping.
Yeah,
they're betting. They're taking the odds and just kind of just, you know, making money. It's like stock. I guess that would be more like the stock market.
Sounds like arbitrage on the stock market or something. And what Duke is referring to when he says not making money, if you're getting money kicked back to you in the form of a rebate, as long as you keep it at zero, your pockets are lined. And you know, it's a scary thing to think that we have to play against people like that. But as people like Duke can attest to, there is a reason to continue to try, because you can still grind it out in the face of them and be clever enough and look at the world differently enough to stake out an edge. I mean, you're still happy to be a horse player in this day and age, Duke?
Oh, yeah, I love it. I mean, it's in my blood. I'm sitting here in front of my computer doing replays from Finger Lakes today. I mean, how sick am I? Mm-hmm.
Well, all three of us have questions for you. I could dominate the conversation. I'm going to let the guys ask around, and then I'll jump back in a little bit. But, Jonathan, you want to jump in and ask Duke a question?
Yeah, no, I just, you know, I think that, well, one of the things we've talked about on the show quite a bit, and I know, Duke, you have a lot of experience with it, is bias and how it can be. I think that it's probably, you know, we've argued that it's the most overrated thing in racing based on how many people will declare it so quickly without the information to actually know if there is or isn't a bias. But I also find it to be probably the most valuable thing, and if you do it the right way and you know about it. So at what time did you kind of discover that bias was real and kind of your basic way of approaching it?
I discovered bias probably when in the late 80s or early 90s at Finger Lakes. Speaking of Finger Lakes, I'm watching today. They had one of the biggest inside speed biases that I've ever seen. Yeah, in like the late 80s and early 90s. It just seemed like it was every day. The horse would get to the rail. It was almost like a conveyor belt. Like they'd line up 1, 2, 3, and they'd run right, you know, they'd run right around the track. The horses, I'm talking about the horses that were on the rail, you know. The horses that would press outside, one would come up and he'd quit, and then the next one would come up the rail and challenge. And it just, that, to me, I figured out there had to be some sort of bias. I mean, it just couldn't happen every day where the horses on the inside were winning and the horses on the outside were quitting. Think you're right. I think you're right about one thing about people they almost try to invent a bias in their, you know. They look at the race and they say, oh, two races went wire to wire. It's got to be a speed bias. You know, that speed biases are usually caused, they're not really biases. Speed bias is usually caused by horses getting loose on the lead because horses like being loose on the lead and they keep running. When they get challenged on the lead, that's when they start quitting. So a lot of times when you see a two-horse duel inside and out and the inside horse keeps going on, that might tell me that you might have what I call an inside bias, not a speed bias, because the track will carry them sometimes. And I think that's caused just by the track being not as deep on the inside, you know. And also the horses are losing ground as they go out, you know, as they get wider. But approaching it in a betting thing is, you know, you can do it on the day of the bias, but you got to be very good at designing races. You got to be very good at, you know, you got to have good pace speed figures so that you know who's going to be up front, who's going to be inside, who's going to be outside. Plus, you got to pay attention to what jockey might maybe know to save more ground or what jockeys aren't saving ground. I think those are good angles. You know, certain guys like to be wide, certain guys like to be inside. I think that helps when you're trying to figure out, you know, a play for what I call a bias play. Post positions start to mean more too when you have an inside or outside bias. So things come in a little bit, you know, differently when you do have a bias, but you got to make sure that there really is one. You can't just invent it in your head.
Am I right, Duke, in saying that the type of biases you described from back in the day at Fort Erie and Finger Lakes, I feel like that type of very obvious bias, we're seeing those types less and less, and I feel like the variety of biases you see in 2016 are way more subtle. Would you agree with that?
I do agree with that totally. I think the track superintendents are a lot better, even though I don't know what the guy does in New York, but he seems to change the track every race, it seems. But I think for the most part, the track superintendents are better at keeping the track, you know, fair. I think they have a better understanding of how deep it is. They have better instruments. They have better tools and better, you know, better harrows and all that. I think they just have better equipment than they used to have. So I don't think you find those. Like, there used to be back in the day, Suffolk Downs had a track where the closer to the outside rail you were, the better. I mean, guys used to ride like 20 pads out in the track, and you don't see that ever anymore. So I just think it's just because the equipment is better.
Yeah, and it makes sense, like the institutional knowledge and whatnot. There was an article in the paper this week by Mike Watchmaker where he gives his views on the Preakness watch, always worth checking out on drf.com or in the paper. In this particular column, he was writing about his vision sort of what a track bias is that, for me, didn't like account, and I respect his opinion tremendously, but just in this one thing he said, I wasn't sure that it accounted for me for all the subtlety that you can sometimes see in a biased track. The specific thing he was talking about was the Derby Day track, which for me watching live, I thought, you know, with some exceptions based on races that had very hot paces, I didn't think represented necessarily as much closing as I would have expected to see, and therefore I was kind of thinking, well, maybe in a race from Derby Day that didn't have a particularly strong pace, maybe I'm going to look to upgrade some of those closers and downgrade some of those front runners when they come back and run. I was just curious about your specific thoughts on the Derby Day track. Maybe you can save me some money here in my hypothesis.
I wish I could, because I'm still confused about Derby Day. I don't think I think I only hit one race on Derby Day, and it was a turf race. So I'm trying to – oh, yeah, I hit the Divisadero race. But Derby Day, to me, the dirt track, I thought it was pretty fast. I thought the track was playing very fast. So, you know, when the track's playing faster, they don't come back usually. But I thought the pace in the Derby was very, very honest. I mean,
yes.
I definitely wasn't slow, you know. It wasn't a slow pace. It wasn't blazing, but it wasn't slow either. I know it was 45, was it 45 and change to the half or something, which is normally a little quick, but on that day I'd say it was just a hair fast. So I don't think Exaggerator had much of an excuse, you know. I think he should have beat Nyquist. I mean, he didn't really get in a lot of trouble. I think the race announcer said he got in trouble on the turn. I watched it a couple times. It might have cost him maybe a length, maybe. But he definitely wasn't going to beat Nyquist.
Mike, why don't you jump in with a question?
Yeah, I was curious. I mean, we kind of talked about it a little bit, and we've discussed on the show whether or not and how the track was playing on Derby Day. To my eyes, it seems less like a speed versus closer bias and more like, and I've watched a few races and kind of looked a little bit deeper, more that what you wanted was you wanted to be in the 2-3-4 paths rather than against the rail. And maybe that's what some people were seeing, and Pete, maybe that's what you were seeing in terms of speed holding. It's some of the speed in the pressing and stalking position that went on while some of the others weren't able to rally. Is Duke, Pete, Jonathan, any of you guys seeing it the same way, or am I kind of crazy here?
No, I don't think you're crazy. I think the normal Churchill track, you do want to be in those three paths, like the 2-3-4. I mean, what I call their normal track, that seems to be the case. Stalkers do really well at Churchill. So I don't think you're crazy at all. I think that's very possible, but, I mean, I still don't think it would have changed the outcome of that particular race. But maybe, who knows? Like I said, I wasn't close. I didn't use Nyquist or Exaggerator, so.
Or Gunman.
I wasn't in the top.
Well, we got this big contest coming up at Santa Anita over the weekend, Duke. You've had tremendous success in their series of live bankroll events that they've been running over the last few years. You won one last fall. I'd like to hear, are you a bit of a Santa Anita horse for course, or is this basically you expect to have success given this format?
I really like the format. I like, because I do it every day, I bet my own money every day. I like taking a little bit of a chance early where I think some guys just kind of coast along. So I think getting ahead in those tournaments is a big advantage. I like Santa Anita in general. I feel comfortable betting that track, and so I think I have a somewhat of an edge, and I have done well there. So I do expect to do well.
Are you going to be playing a second entry, or are you going to stick with the one you won on DRFQ?
I haven't decided yet, but I probably will play two, just because I won one. I was a little lucky and unlucky to win that the other day.
Explain what you mean.
That tournament, I started out in the very first race. I think the very first race was a race at Mom. I think it was a turf race. And I switched my pick at, like, with 1 minute to post, because I was playing a couple tournaments that day. I was playing that tournament that had almost 2,000 people in it. And I took the horse off that I left the Bomb on that contest and took a shorter price on the one that I actually ended up finishing second in. And that almost cost me, because if I took that horse, I would have been leading the whole entire tournament the entire day, and I never would have been in doubt. And instead, I had to come from behind in the last race with a little help from JK on the workouts on that money multiplier horse.
Yeah, we were talking about that before you got on the air with us, Duke, about the DRF Clocker report mentioning that Money Multiplier had been working with Flincher and the assumptions that could be made because of that. I want to ask you about turf racing in general. It's something we talked about with Paul a little bit and how he thought that maybe just a little bit of the success you guys had at this year's NHC, where he won and you ran fourth, came from the fact that there was so little turf racing, and just talked in general about his preference for dirt racing over turf racing. Many contest players love the turf racing and the crazy prices that sometimes ensue with them. Is it just the big prices and some of the weird horses that make you like turf racing less, or is there something else to your lack of love for the stuff on the green?
I think the turf racing issue with Paul and me is that it's so, the results are very random. I mean, because the paces are much slower, the horses are in tight packs, whereas the dirt, I think speed means so much more, and horses get spread out. And in the turf, I think trip means even more, and pace even means maybe sometimes even more than that. And you can bet a horse that you think is going to be, you know, well-placed, and he may be last for no reason. You know, like he might take one bad step out of the gate or the jockey might have different ideas of taking the horse back this time. I just think that you can almost – I wish there was surrender in turf racing. You know, I have surrender in blackjack. A lot of times you bet a horse and you just have – you know, after a quarter mile, you have no chance. You know, because they're crawling up front, and you're not where you're supposed to be. So it's like, I just think it's that. I mean, it's funny that, on like I said, on Derby Day, the best race I had was the Divisadero and a World Approval Exacta. So I mean, it's not always the case where I hate turf racing. So I've been following that horse Divisadero for a while, and he had trips, and eventually, you know, I guess eventually, if you keep betting them, they eventually get a good trip.
That's always the hope anyway. You talk about that phenomenon with the paces and sort of the stereotypical approach that jockeys seem to have in turf races, reserving energy and finishing. Do we think that's something that's legitimately inherent to racing on the grass? Or is this maybe a case where it's become almost like a cultural thing among the jockeys and they're just not aggressive enough? I mean, I think about a grass horse like Frankel. To me, like American Pharoah was almost the dirt version of him. They just forwardly placed, click off 12-second furlongs, and keep running. Is there something to this idea that turf horse has to be reserved and finished late, or do you think it could maybe be a little more complicated than that?
You know, I'm not really a good one to judge that, but I do think they go way too slow. I mean, I think there's plenty of turf horses that can click off 12. I mean, if they're allowed to, they're just never allowed to. It just doesn't seem like any of these guys, they don't want to lose the race in the first part of the race. That's what it seems like anyway. These guys, the modern jockeys don't want to lose in the beginning, but makes them, what they don't realize is it does make them lose. By taking a horse back that shouldn't be taken back, you know, they lose it right away. And I think it's a lot of jockey and trainer combination. I think the trainers like to see their horses finish, and instead of, you know, what Paul and I call downline. Downline is what we refer to as when the horses basically spit the bit, you know, at the end of the race. You know, they're done, they're tired. But I think trainers don't like to see that in a turf race. But
I was just going to mention I'm sorry, Duke. You go ahead.
No, go ahead. I was done.
The point I was going to make is we talk about jockeys, but I think you're absolutely right to mention the idea of the jockeys are kind of just doing what the trainers want them to. So I don't mean to just stick the bill for my theory there on the boys. I think it's something that's more on the horseman side in general. And I think you make a great point when we're used to these turf horses finishing like powerhouses. Maybe you don't want to be the one that's way off the bridle at the line and doesn't want to gallop out 50 yards past the wire. That makes a ton of sense. We'll only keep you for a couple of more minutes, Duke, but I want to give the guys a chance to ask another question each before we let you go and end this edition of the DRF Players Pod. Jonathan, you got something else for Duke?
Well, I think the reason Duke does so well at Santa Anita is because they have one of his favorite wines there. So I think that really has a lot to do with it.
We got to give the plug. Yeah. What wine are we talking about here?
Cake bread.
Okay, cake bread.
Cake bread. Chardonnay,
cake bread. That's the LASIX for
they
Duke.
They do a great job at Santa Anita in general with anything that you need. So I mean. That there's no better track in the country for that. I can't get cake bread at Saratoga, I can assure you that. I bring it myself.
Mike, you got one? There you go. Put it in something that isn't glass and bring it right. Put it in a soda bottle and they let you walk it in. That's the advantage of Saratoga. Mike, you got one more for Duke?
Yeah, I'm going to ask Duke the question, Pete, that you asked Jonathan and me last week. Duke, are we going to see a second Triple Crown winner in 2 years?
It's very possible. The only thing is, you know, I know those guys I know the guys that are associated with the training of Nyquist, and this is the second time they've got me, because before the Breeders' Cup, they said the horse was training terrible, and you saw how he ran. He ran unbelievable. And again, I got a call morning of the Derby telling me horse is training terrible again. And, you know, I'm done listening to the camp, because if they didn't really like him, anyone like that, I don't know. I don't know what to think. So I think he's definitely good enough. He's definitely good enough, and he ran. I thought he ran great. So he was in what you would call the Churchill path, you know, that three path. But still, I still thought he was the best on that day.
Just proof once again that nobody knows nothing. When it's all said and done. Well, Duke, we could keep you another half hour, but we're not going to do that to you. I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and I look forward to getting a chance to split a bottle of cake bread Chardonnay, perhaps in the Eddie Logan Suite or some other desirable location this weekend. Folks listening, if you want to join in, you can still sign up for the contest. Up to 2 entries are permitted. I'll have all the details on the site and in the paper in the coming days. If you're interested in getting in there, check out the Santa Anita website or contact our pal, Nate Newby at Santa Anita, and he'll be sure to sort you right out. JK, make a decision. Are you playing in this contest or what?
Duke got me all fired up now with the cake bread talk, so yeah, I'll be there.
All right, there. We got one more player in. Maybe somebody listening will come in and win it, and then we can write that story up next weekend in the paper. I want to thank Duke Matisse once again. Always a pleasure. I want to thank Jonathan Kitchen. I want to thank Mike Hogan. And most of all, I want to thank all of you for listening, tuning in, downloading, writing reviews on iTunes, and all that good stuff. We will be back with you. Mike and I are going to be doing a webinar later this week on Thursday with Andy Beyer and Steve Christigan. You'll see the banner for that. Please sign up and join for that. The podcast will be back presumably Friday morning. We'll nail that down, and we'll tell you on Twitter if that changes. Until then, may you win all your photos.